This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Down to Business. My name is Jeff, and I'm recording this episode from the Mind's Eye studio just outside St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. In today's episode, we'll explore a variety of stories from some of my favorite business publications, including Fast Company, Fortune, and Forbes. So settle in. It's time to get down to business. Our first article for this episode comes from Business Insider, and it's entitled U.S. Recession Outlook, Top Economist Predicts Downturn to Hit by Summer. President Donald Trump's tariffs could unleash a recession on the U.S. economy by this summer, Apollo's chief economist Torsten Slok said. In a note over the weekend, Slok outlined a timeline for how the tariffs, especially steep duties on goods from China, could lead to a sharp slowdown in trade that crushes demand and fuels layoffs in trucking, retail, and beyond. Here's how the top economist sees an economic slowdown unfolding over the coming weeks. First, in early to mid-May, uncertainty has risen sharply following the chaos of the April 2nd Liberation Day tariff unveiling and the subsequent 90-day delay of most reciprocal duties. As April winds down, Slok flagged that the typical 20 to 40-day transit time for container ships from China suggests that container traffic to U.S. ports could come to a stop by the middle of May. In mid to late May, from there, goods and ports typically take up to 10 days to reach cities nationwide via trucks and railroads. That means that as container flows ebb, trucking demand could start to crumble by mid to late May. In late May to early June, the ripple effects of Trump's tariffs could lead to empty shelves and force companies to respond to lower sales by laying off workers across the trucking and retail industries. The rough timeline puts the U.S. on track to enter a recessionary period this summer. He backed up his prediction with data showing that companies and consumers are already negatively adjusting their behavior to the looming tariffs. The outlook for corporate earnings has seen the sharpest decline since the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020. New orders across various indices tracked by the Federal Reserve are collapsing, and recent surveys show a sharp reversal in corporate CapEx spending plans, Slok said. Executives warn of recession signals. In addition to the data, executives at U.S. firms are airing their concerns about recessionary behavior. Here are a few recent comments that Slok flagged. I don't care if you call it a recession or not. In this industry, that's a recession. This from Robert Jordan, the CEO of Southwest Airlines, referring to expectations of lower revenue in the second quarter. Saving money because of concerns around the economy was the overwhelming reason consumers were reducing the frequency of restaurant visits. This from Scott Boatwright, the CEO of Chipotle, speaking on the restaurant chain's first quarter earnings call. And finally, relative to where we were 3 months ago, we probably aren't feeling as good about the consumer now, said Jamie Caulfield, the CEO of PepsiCo, speaking on the company's first quarter earnings call. Furthermore, betting markets see a rising chance of recession. According to data from Kalshi, chances of a recession hitting the U.S. economy in 2025 remain elevated at 57% as of Monday morning. The odds were about 43 just before Trump unveiled his tariffs on April 2nd, and just 19% the day before Trump was inaugurated for his second presidential term. Our next article comes from Fast Company, and it's entitled Bad News for Tesla. Trump might kill the climate credits that have been a key part of its business model. One crucial factor helped keep Tesla profitable last quarter, and it wasn't direct car sales. In its largest earning report, the company said that it earned $595 million from selling regulatory credits to other automakers. The credits are issued by governments, including California, that require car companies to hit certain emission goals by selling cleaner vehicles. If they don't, they have to make up the gap by buying credits from companies like Tesla that make zero-emission cars. Tesla's sales tanked in the first quarter as Elon Musk's dive into politics pushed away customers, both in the U.S. and internationally. The company reported that it earned $409 million in the first quarter of 2025, down 71% from the same quarter a year ago. Without the revenue from selling credits, Tesla would have posted a $186 million loss. Now, President Trump is actively trying to dismantle the system that makes the credits possible. Republicans in Congress are helping with that effort. The House is set to vote this week on a bill that aims to take away California's right to have strict air quality standards and the market for zero-emission vehicles credits that exist in the state. The credits have been important since Tesla's beginning. In the early years, it really is what kept them out of bankruptcy, says David Sperling, founding director of the Institute for Transportation Studies at UC Davis. Sperling previously helped set up the zero emissions vehicle credit system in California. Multiple other states that follow California's air quality standards, from Colorado to Virginia, also issue the credits. While Tesla also earns money from a credit system in Europe and a small amount through a federal program, most of the credits it sells are in California and other states. At points in the company's history when it particularly struggled, credits kept it going. The company was structurally unprofitable for a long, long time, says Ed Niedermeyer, author of Ludicrous, the unvarnished story of Tesla Motors. If the cushion of the credits hadn't existed, the company might look very different now. Musk once considered a sale to Google as one of Tesla's low points, for example. In theory, the company might not have even survived. The credits still matter. Eventually, Tesla was selling enough cars that it became profitable without the credits, at least until now. But the credits continued playing an important role. Especially given the economic uncertainty right now, it remains an important driver for a type of profit in pre-cash flows, says Seth Goldstein, an equity analyst at Morningstar. Credits also helped it accrue about $37 billion in cash. If we do have a long-term economic slowdown, Tesla should be able to withstand the slowdown because it does have such a strong balance sheet. So I'll attribute that to the credit allowing Tesla to put itself in a very strong position. The credits weren't designed to last forever, and Goldstein argues that Tesla is positioning itself not to need them. As more automakers make EVs, they'll have to buy fewer credits from electric-first companies like Tesla. Eventually, if California can keep its plan in place, all new car sales in the state will be zero emission by 2035. But as the state ramps up its emission requirements on the way to that goal, some brand may not be able to keep up the pace and credits will become more valuable. The value of the credits is pretty low right now because the market is outpacing the regulatory requirements, says Sperling. But that's going to change probably within a year or two. If the authority stays in place and the regulations stay in place, those credits are going to become more and more valuable. As Tesla's sales falters, the credits play a more important role. The drop in sales isn't solely because of that damage that Musk has caused with the brand. Other car companies now offer a suite of options for EVs that customers may find more appealing, especially as Tesla has been slow to roll out new models. Musk has touted Tesla's work on robotics and automation, but neither are ready to immediately come to market. The company has promised to do a more affordable car, but likely won't be out until next year. The sales of its current lineup of cars are still critical, which means that credits are too. No one knows what's next. The state credits are at risk in two ways. Right now, they're possible because of California's longstanding right to regulate air pollution. When the Clean Air Act passed in 1970, California already had air quality laws, so it was given a waiver to continue setting its own strict emission standards for cars. Other states also have the option to follow California. Trump tried to eliminate that waiver in his first term, and California and other states sued. When Biden took office, with the lawsuit still underway, he restored the waiver. But fuel producers and industry groups sued, saying that the EPA shouldn't have put the waiver back in place, and the Supreme Court is now considering whether that lawsuit can proceed. Separately, congressional Republicans are trying to reverse the EPA's waiver for California's plans to phase out new gas cars and trucks. The House will vote this week. In the Senate, the parliamentarian has said that the Congress doesn't have the authority to repeal the waivers, but Senate Republicans may try anyway. Whatever happens, more lawsuits will follow, and that means that the regulatory credits won't immediately disappear, and Tesla, for now, will be able to keep using them even as Elon Musk continues to rant about government handouts. Our next article can be found in the Los Angeles Times. It's entitled, Bay Area Tech Workers Thought Their Jobs Were Safe, Then the Golden Handcuffs Came Off. The tech industry, once seen as a relatively stable place to grow a career, continues to be hit by job cuts in 2025. Tech companies, including Meta, Block, Autodesk, and others, are among businesses that have slashed their workforce. Evan Richardson grew up in Silicon Valley, surrounded by big tech companies that transform how people live, socialize, and work. As a curious kid, Richardson took apart electronics and put them back together. A career in technology seemed like a natural and safe path after his service in the military. Tech was always an industry you go into, you're going to make a lot of money, and you're never going to get fired, he said. For thousands of tech workers like Richardson, those days are over. In March, the 43-year-old Hayward resident was caught off guard when he learned his employer, payment company Square, was eliminating his role as a development and operations engineer because of a reorganization. Square's parent company, Oakland-based Block, planned to shed 931 jobs, or 8% of its workforce, citing performance issues and the need to create more streamlined operations. In California, the cuts will begin next month and affect 240 employees, including engineers, designers, and writers, according to a notice sent to the state's Employment Development Department. Block is among major San Francisco Bay Area tech companies slashing their payrolls this year. Meta, Google, Autodesk, Workday, and others also announced job cuts. Intel is planning to cut more than 20% of its workforce, Bloomberg reported. On Thursday, the Santa Clara-based chipmaker confirmed it would be laying off workers to drive better, more efficient execution across the business. I'm a big believer in the philosophy that the best leaders get the most done with the fewest people, Intel chief executive Lip-Bu Tan told employees in an email. The company lost $821 million in the first quarter. In a region known for boom and bust cycles, these tech industry layoffs are delivering a blow to a sector that is vital to California's economy. Recently ranked as the world's fourth largest. In addition to supporting high-salary jobs, tech companies offer employees stock options so the state benefits from taxing capital gains, the profit earned when the shareholder sells their stock for a higher price. When cuts are happening in Silicon Valley, traditionally it's affected everything from wages and taxes to even state revenue, says Kevin Clowden, executive director at the Milliken Institute, an economic think tank in Santa Monica. The numbers are bleak, though not as bad as in 2023 when layoffs surged. U.S. tech companies announced 37,000 job cuts from January to March, down 13% from the same period last year, according to a report from Challenger, a firm that offers job search and career transition coaching. In 2023, tech companies announced 102,000 in cuts during the first 3 months of that year. In California, companies in the first quarter of this year announced 17,000 cuts in technology, which includes businesses mainly engaged in the development of software or manufacturing of computer hardware, according to Challenger. The firm gathers data from news reports, company filings, annual reports, news releases, and layoff notices. Overhiring during the pandemic, when more people turned to online shopping, video conferencing, and social media, fueled much of the layoffs in recent years, experts say. A lot of these tech companies that hired to the moon are falling back down to earth. But other factors are driving the latest round of layoffs, economists say. They say companies are measuring people's productivity and performance more closely, and that they are shifting resources toward artificial intelligent investments. Economic uncertainty prompted by regulatory changes such as tariffs and shifts in immigration policies are also driving businesses to rein in cost. There's just a general unease about the economy, particularly over the last several months. We've seen a slowdown in hiring really across the board, says Dante D'Antonio, Senior Director of Economic Research at Moody's Analytics. For tech workers reeling from all the job losses, the industry feels far less stable. Technology evolves rapidly, and so can a company's priorities. One day you're in, the next day you're out. Though some are weighing whether they want to stay in tech, others find it tough to let go of the high salaries, the benefits, and the perks. Maria Jose Calero was laid off from Autodesk after 6 years at the San Francisco company, where she worked as a program manager and business partner. Autodesk, which makes software used by architects, designers, and engineers, announced in February it will cut 1,350 positions, or roughly 9% of its workforce. It cited geopolitical and macroeconomic factors, along with its efforts to invest more heavily in AI, a regulatory filing said. Those reasons were little consolation for Calero. The 36-year-old San Francisco resident says the tech industry offered stability and opportunities to grow her career. She's considering jobs in other industries, including healthcare and hospitality, but isn't sure they will pay enough to cover her bills, a mortgage for her daughter's daycare. Tech is hard to walk away from, she said. It's like golden handcuffs, because where do you find a salary that matches what you had? With major companies such as Meta saying they're targeting low performers, unemployed workers have pushed back against the claims on social media. Among them is Adam Espinosa, who recently lost his job as a software engineer at Meta. In February, the social network started cutting about 5% of its workforce, or roughly 3,600 employees, the latest in a series of job reductions in recent years. Espinosa said that he met all expectations, was even talking to his manager about a promotion when he was told he would be let go. That also indicates to me that I shouldn't have been on the chopping block, but here I was, the 28-year-old said. Like other workers, Espinosa said that he's seen a culture shift within tech companies, which have moved away from the efforts to promote diversity. At Meta, he said it felt like if you didn't consistently exceed expectations as an engineer, you could get replaced by AI, or the company could hire someone new for a lower pay or less compensation. Still, he has no intention of leaving the industry. He grew up in Roseanne, and the area of the dial-up internet and AOL was drawn to how engineers solved problems. His career in tech eventually brought him to San Francisco. I'm planning on staying in the tech industry for now. It is definitely something that I love doing, he said. Chase Forty Landis, who was laid off from his job at a software company, Zendesk, is still processing what happened. The San Francisco-based company said in February that it was laying off 51 employees in California, according to a notice filed with the state. The cuts included senior managers, the vice president of product, and principal managers. Through layoffs that happened in the company before, Forty Landis said that his team was already lean, so losing his security analysis job came as a total surprise. Zendesk had slashed 8% of its workforce in 2023. I was made to think it could never happen to me, he said. Forty Landis, 31, who worked at Zendesk for more than 4 years, pivoted into tech after working as a sales associate and a teacher. Pondering his next career move, he thought about whether he should work outdoors as a park ranger. So many times you'd just be working at a desk or working on the computer, he said, and you look outside and you're just like, God, it's gorgeous out there. Our next article comes once again from Business Insider, and the headline is 80% of small businesses that buy from China will die, according to the Flexport CEO. The CEO of logistics company Flexport has a grim forecast for what could happen if the U.S. sticks to its tariffs on China. The U.S. 145% duty on Chinese products could lead to mass bankruptcies, Flexport CEO Ryan Peterson said on an episode of the Proofing G Pod, which aired on Friday. You're talking like 80% of small businesses that buy from China will just die, he said, and millions of employees will be unemployed. The logistics CEO added that a lot of what Americans buy from China is discretionary spend, optional items that can be replaced if they become expensive. We have customers that buy pizza ovens in China, like for your backyard. They're really cool products, he said. When the price goes up 50% or more, you might just go out and buy pizza from Domino's or something. He said this is why he thinks the U.S. should back down in a trade war with China. The White House did not respond to a request for a comment. Last month, Peterson said customers feel paralyzed around tariffs, especially because of the manner that they are being carried out. He says no country feels like a safe bet for supply chains, especially after President Donald Trump placed duties on Canada and Mexico, two of the U.S.'s closest trading partners. Peterson found the logistics company in 2013 and raised $935 million in 2022 at an $8 billion valuation. He says people aren't going to buy. Earlier this month, Trump said he might be nearing a point where he wouldn't want to impose higher tariffs on China because it could deter consumption in the U.S. Speaking to reporters in the Oval Office on April 17th, Trump said he may not raise tariffs even if China goes beyond its 125% duty on U.S. goods. I may not want to go higher, or I may not want to even go up to that level. I may want to go less because you want people to buy, and at a certain point, people aren't going to buy, he said. Earlier on the same day, China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said it wouldn't pay attention to Trump's tariff numbers game after the White House said Chinese exports face a levy of up to 245%. Beijing previously called escalating U.S. tariffs a joke and said they no longer hold any economic significance. The U.S. imported $439 billion worth of goods from China in 2024, according to the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. China makes up over 13% of its total imports. Earlier this month, five owner-operated businesses from different states and industries filed a lawsuit in the U.S. Court of International Trade challenging Trump's authority to impose tariffs by invoking the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. They argue that the tariffs violate constitutional limits on executive power. Large businesses are also warning of widespread economic disruption. Southwest Airlines CEO said last week that the U.S. airline industry is already in a recession. Our next article comes from the Philadelphia Inquirer, entitled, Could Tariffs Cancel Halloween and Christmas in 2025? Philadelphia area small business owners are worried. Companies that depend on holiday sales rely heavily on Chinese factories. I don't have an option to buy these products domestically, said one local business owner. South Jersey business owner Robert Berman types the same words into his phone search bar every morning when he wakes up and every night before he goes to bed. China-U.S. tariff update. It's been part of his daily routine since President Donald Trump started increasing tariffs on many Chinese imports. Among those imports are the costumes, hats, and props the Berman family has sold at Raza Impasta and Pasta Costumes for more than three decades. As of Friday, U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods like these were at 145%. Impasta had about 3 million worth of products, including next season's Halloween costumes, sitting in a factory in China earlier this week. The Berman said wholesale customers had asked the Runnymede-based company to pause orders as the business community waits to see whether the tariffs stick. This week, Walmart indicated intentions to cut back its orders so much that Impasta would no longer turn a profit, said Tina Wayne Bierman, the chief creative officer. A Walmart spokesperson on Friday said they had not canceled any orders. We're running the risk of having to shut down for a couple of months, Tina Wayne Berman said. These are actual fatal blows. Trump said on Tuesday that the tariffs on Chinese imports could come down substantially, but did not indicate when or by how much. The Wall Street Journal reported Wednesday that the president was considering cutting tariffs on some goods by more than half. If high tariffs on China stay in place, companies like mine could go out of business, says Robert Berman, Impasta's CEO. Big box stores could cancel their orders, he said, and the prices of products sold on Amazon or the company's website would skyrocket. A $40 costume could now be $100. And would the consumer spend $100 for a banana costume to wear to the Savannah Bananas baseball game? Will they wear that, or will they just say, we'll buy a t-shirt? Trump has said that the tariffs are intended to boost U.S. manufacturing and create American jobs, and encourage consumers to buy homegrown products. But in recent weeks, they have led to economic turmoil, market volatility, and lots of uncertainty. Seasonal business owners are among those feeling anxious. Companies that depend on holiday sales plan their inventory months in advance. These retailers usually rely on Chinese factories, which make about 87% of all the Christmas decor sold in the U.S., according to Reuters. The Mount Laurel-based Halloween and Costume Association, of which Berman is a board member, released a statement earlier this month which the subject line, "Tariffs threaten to cancel Halloween and cripple Christmas." On a recent 70-degree day in South Philadelphia, Derek Gould was already worried about the winter holidays. He is the vice president of Orman, Inc., a 100-year-old family-run importer of fall and Christmas decor, including holiday lights. "We're not quite at the part of the season yet where it could make or break us," he said of the tariffs, "but that's fast approaching." Orman is also in tariff limbo, Gould said, with hundreds of thousands of dollars of holiday decor sitting in China. "Eating that cost is not feasible," said Gould, who supplies holiday lights to professional, commercial, and residential installers. "We'll have to close our doors." He said he doesn't know if a viable alternative to manufacturing in China exists. "I don't have an option to buy these products domestically. I never have," he said. "Could they ultimately be produced there? I guess, but it would be a multi-year venture. You're talking about building factories, staffing factories, and training employees." For 5 years in the 1990s, in Pasta's colorful Austin Powers-inspired suit, costumes were made in the factory in Philadelphia's Chinatown. Robert Berman said, but then the factory closed, unable to compete with its counterparts overseas. "We realized we had to go overseas or we'd be out of business," said Tina Wayne Berman. Robert Berman, her husband, says he doesn't see cut-and-sew manufacturing coming back to the U.S. "Where could we do it? Where could we find people to train to be in the sewing machine operators?" he said. "It's an industry that has left America." The Bermans hope that their business can survive as an American success story. It's one that got its start when Robert Berman glued wool dreadlocks to a baseball cap and sold the hat off his head for $20 and a beer at a Long Beach Island bar. The couple met shortly after when Robert approached Tina to ask if she'd sell his hat at her Beach Haven boutique, the Mod Hatter. The company officially started in Robert Parent's Cherries Hill basement and then moved to Runnymede, building that his father and uncle owned for their candy and tobacco company. Once the country's top producer of adult humor costumes, their selection now runs the gamut from banana and hot dog suits to officially licensed costumes, branded beer bottles, the Flyers mascot Gritty, even a replica of Jason Kelce's Murmurs regalia from the 2018 Eagles Super Bowl parade. Robert Berman's sister and co-business partner, Jody, shared the family's plight with U.S. Senator Annie Kim at a town hall on Tuesday. "Soon your Halloween costumes will be $100, and that's if you can get the product," she told the hundreds gathered at the Cherry Hill. "My business potentially can go bankrupt from this disaster." "What is Congress or even the state preparing to do to help small businesses like mine?" she asked, a longtime Democrat from South Jersey. The senator vowed to try to get support for small businesses, telling Berman, "You have every right to be upset about this, to be viscerally angry about where things stand." "Even if tariffs are reduced," Gould said, "it may not be smooth sailing." "Every importer is going to have a mad dash to get their stuff on the water," Gould said. "It certainly could end up creating a logjam. But it'd be worse if tariffs remain. He'd have to cancel about 75% of his holiday decor shipments," he said, with the saving grace being that the rest come from Cambodia, Indonesia, Thailand, and the Philippines. "Those countries are subject to tariffs too," Gould said, "but those are smaller than and ones that we can handle." Our next article can be found in Inc. magazine, and it's entitled, "Consider These Three Things Before Starting a Business in Today's Economy. Here's how you can grow a thriving business in this uncertain time." Small businesses are the backbone of the U.S. economy, totaling 33 million nationwide and making up 99.9% of all businesses, according to the U.S. Small Business Administration. They play a critical role in job creation and economic growth. Even as small business owners today grapple with rising costs, labor shortages, shifting tariff policies, inflation, and supply chain disruptions, business applications are surging. The U.S. averaged 430,000 new business applications per month in 2024, a 50% increase compared to 2019. This trend highlights the resilience of small businesses, the strength of the entrepreneurial spirit, and the enduring dream of starting a business. To shed light on what it really takes to launch a business, I sat down with my Hello Alice co-founder and small business expert, Carolyn Rhodes, as part of Yahoo Finance's show, The Big Idea. Together, we broke down three essential steps every entrepreneur should take to turn their dream into a thriving business in this uncertain time. First, ensure that the market is ready for your business. The key is to carve out the right time to deeply understand the value you'll provide to your target market. Then you'll have to figure out how to capitalize. Entrepreneurs have to take calculated risks. Starting a business is challenging, but with the right mindset, preparation, and financial strategy, success is within reach. While small businesses employ nearly half of the American workforce and represent 43.5% of GDP, they can have high fail rates and difficulty accessing capital. Keep in mind, is your product or service unique to the market? Answer the problem you are fixing or opportunities you are providing. Is there competition that you need to understand in order to dominate? Make a plan to overtake them or a partner to launch alongside in the market. The time of year matters in marketing. Launch when your customer is active. For example, there's a push for back-to-school shopping, holiday engagement, or tax services. Second, manage your capital ahead of launching your business. One of the biggest challenges new entrepreneurs face is financial management. Carolyn and I took a frugal approach when launching Hello Alice. We used credit cards, shared a babysitter, and commuted 2 hours on public transit to build our company. Here are some of our financial tips for those just starting out. You can bootstrap, but remember to avoid excessive debt. While financing is necessary, relying solely on credit cards for personal loans can be risky. Explore small business grants. Government and private grants can provide much-needed capital without repayment obligations. In the early days of Hello Alice, we applied for every grant we could find, and that experience shaped our mission. It's why we've made it a priority to raise $8 million in grants and given away more than $7 million in grants throughout Hello Alice. We know firsthand how much they can mean to a growing business. Finally, diversify your capital. The best funding comes from customer receipts. Managing your capital will be your most important role as a CEO from the day you start until you are a billion-dollar company. Third, find the right time to start your small business. There's no perfect moment to start a business. Most small business owners have an existing job, child care responsibilities, or elder care commitments. Interestingly, the average age of entrepreneurs in America is 45, proving that experience and preparation often lead to success. Whether you're launching a tech startup or a local bakery, remember, first, make sure you have the income you need to support your personal life and household. Double-check that your expected earnings in the early days of your business align with your personal budget. Consider starting the company as a side hustle while you still have a job and build from there. Second, insurance is a real consideration. Be certain that you have medical coverage sorted out for you and your loved one as you get started. And finally, time will be tougher than capital. With your current obligations, evaluate whether you can realistically dedicate the time needed to build your business. In this time of uncertainty, remember that the capital that is least expensive and most reliable is the kind you don't owe back. In other words, money from grants or from your customers. Our next article comes from Fortune magazine, and it's called Revenge RTO, or Return to Office. Workers are coming in late, leaving early, and stealing snacks as they find small ways to get back at their bosses. At an online reselling platform in Chicago, one employee always makes a pit stop by the communal fridge before heading home for the day. The employee, who like other workers interviewed, requested anonymity for fear of retribution, always picks out a few soft drinks and snacks to take home. After her workplace started instituting RTO mandates, forcing her to come in a few days a week, she believes it is her right to take a few extra refreshments. I keep my home fridge fully stocked with all my office drinks, she tells Fortune. If the shareholders are taking my wages, at the very least, I'm going to take 3 Gatorades and a couple of Uncrustables. The Chicago-based employee is just one of the countless workers engaging in a kind of revenge RTO strategy, complying with their workplace demands but taking advantage in other ways like coming in late, leaving early, or stealing snacks. For instance, Reddit's anti-work forum has an entire thread dedicated to brainstorming subtle acts of resistance when it comes to RTO. These include never answering your phone when you're not in the office, spending as much time as possible socializing, bothering your bosses when they look busy, and intentionally burning popcorn in the microwave. Experts tell Fortune that the roots of this defiance can be traced to a wave of RTO mandates instituted with little explanation or thought for employee well-being, which is now leading them to act out in small ways. And although these little rebellions might seem petty, they're actually a sign that workers have lost faith and confidence in their employer in a way that should make managers take notice of their own actions. When employees feel that something is unfair, they act to make it fair, Peter Capelli, professor of management and director of the Center for Human Resources at UPenn's Wharton Business School, tells Fortune. That reflects poorly on the leadership down to the manager. A broken social contract. The COVID-19 pandemic fundamentally changed offices around the world when millions of employees transitioned to remote work on a dime. When pandemic restrictions began to lift, many companies took a soft approach to work arrangements, allowing employees to continue working from home or only requiring them to come in a few days a week. But those privileges have slowly eroded as CEOs and managers become more insistent that employees work from the office all or most of the time. One thing, however, is clear: workers do not want to go back to the old days. A resounding 95% of employees want some form of remote work, according to a 2024 FlexJobs survey. Because remote work is such a cherished benefit, it doesn't surprise me that companies that implement an RTO mandate may have employees who are not thrilled with the decision. Some employers have taken a smarter approach to RTO by basing their mandate on data and communicating effectively with workers. But others have been more heavy-handed and demanded that employees go back into the office with little to no evidence or explanation why. That has made many workers feel that an important social contract has been broken, leading them to act out, says Denise Rousseau, a professor of organizational behavior at Carnegie Mellon. The formal term for this is counterproductive work behavior, defined as voluntary behavior that violates the organization's and social norms of a workplace. The precursors are unfair treatment, broken promises, or perceptions of an employer who does not have the worker's interest at heart, says Rousseau. If this behavior is increasing, it's because employers have violated some implicit agreement. That certainly seems to be the case with one New York City government contract employee that Fortune spoke with. She says she stopped clocking in and out for her lunch hour and now charges the agency for that time. "I'm just going to keep doing it," she tells Fortune. "I have shitty health insurance, so this makes up for it." Another employee at a luxury good brand in New York City that Fortune spoke with said that she has seen an increase in revenge RTO behavior among her colleagues who are required to come to the office 4 days a week, including skipping out for a workout class or taking back food to their families. She adds that if a manager or member of leadership leaves early, other employees follow suit. "Because we don't want to be here so often, we really are taking advantage of the moments when it's okay to leave because nobody really sees it," she says. Goodwill is taken for granted. Employees who take a few extra bags of Cheez-Its or lightly embellish a doctor's appointment might be aggravating for bosses, but they should think twice about trying to track down on workers taking small liberties. "If I'm an employer, before I get all my nose all out of joint for the insubordination, I think it's important to recognize that there are all kinds of rules that get violated all the time," says Capelli. That's especially true when workplace norms have recently changed. You might think this is really fundamental, but have you done anything to persuade people that really is fundamental now, because it wasn't the week before? These microtransgressions, however, can also signal a deeper problem, A company may have flubbed the way that they communicated their RTO demands, overlooked the needs of groups that particularly value flexible schedules, or generally made their workers feel unappreciated. It's a heads up to the company that they have benefited from people's goodwill for many years and that they don't want to throw that away, said Rousseau. Experts emphasize that there's still hope for employers trying to cut down on incidents of RTO revenge and say the solution is quite simple. Listen to your workers. Town halls, anonymous surveys, and collecting feedback from managers are all different ways to better understand the kind of work arrangements that are compatible with employee productivity and the kind of policies that will win back their trust. Rousseau argues that there is no way to move forward as an organization without incorporating some types of employee feedback, and she warns that any company doing so proceeds at their own peril. I don't think that not caring is an option, she says. Our next article can be found in Fast Company magazine, and it's called It's Time to Ditch the Traditional Offsite. Here are four ways to rethink your next corporate retreat. We've all been there. The windowless conference room, the stale coffee, the flip charts, the obligatory icebreaker, followed by hours of sticky notes and talk of disruption that feels, ironically, deeply uninspired. This is the traditional corporate offsite, a manufactured attempt at connection and creativity staged inside four beige walls. But here's the truth that most leaders won't say out loud. If your strategy session could have been an email, your offsite isn't working. In a world demanding fresh thinking, deep alignment, and courageous reinvention, we don't need more sticky notes. We need more perspective, pause, and place. It's time to rethink the offsite. It's not a retreat from work, but a return to what makes work matter. The traditional offsite is designed for control, a fixed agenda, predictable outputs, and highly curated team-building exercises. But innovation is inherently unpredictable. Creativity doesn't follow a schedule, and a breakthrough doesn't happen when people feel boxed in, either literally or figuratively. A recent Steelcase study found that only 13% of employees strongly agree that their workplace helps them be creative. Imagine taking that same creative tension and relocating it to a stuffy hotel ballroom with bad lighting and bad air. It's just uninspiring. It's counterproductive. If you want to unlock real innovation, you need to get out of the room, literally. I have taken executive teams hiking in the mountains, walked through sculpture parks, sketching beside rivers, and sharing stories under open skies. What happens in those moments isn't just memorable, it's transformative. Creativity doesn't thrive in confinement, it thrives in movement, reflection, and meaningful environments. Here's what shifts when you leave the room. Your perspective expands. On a recent mountain trail, one of my clients looked over the valley and said, "I finally see my business differently. Nature helps leaders zoom out, see patterns, and reconnect what really matters." Dialogue deepens. Walking side by side fosters vulnerability in a way that boardroom chairs never will. One CFO told me after a trail walk, "That's the first time I have really talked to my team, not just with them." Energy resets. Changing physical environments resets our mental state. The body moves, the mind loosens, and new insights begin to emerge, often without even trying. Ask yourself, what would happen if your team had space to think, not just speak, to feel instead of just perform? Nature, narrative, and nonlinear thinking. Before you overhaul your next offsite, pause and consider what actually fuels creativity and connection in teams. It's not a tighter agenda or better breakout sessions. It's the deeper human elements that corporate playbooks often overlook. It's the environment that stirs the senses, stories that build shared meaning, and space that honors the messy, magical performance of emergence. At the heart of powerful offsites are three essential elements most corporate agendas ignore. First, nature. Nature doesn't just reduce stress, it rewires our thinking. A Stanford study found that even a 90-minute walk in nature can reduce rumination and improve problem solving. But beyond the science, nature reminds us not everything must be engineered. Some things must be experienced. What might your team discover if they swapped Wi-Fi for tree lines? Second, narrative. The best breakthroughs don't start with strategy decks, they start with stories. When leaders share pivotal life moments or team origin stories, new insights emerge. The strategy becomes personal and the mission gets real. Instead of starting with goals, ask each person to share a moment that shaped how they lead. Watch what opens up. And finally, number three, nonlinear thinking. Great ideas don't arrive on demand. They bubble up in white space, or maybe it should be called green space. That's why I build in unstructured time during offsites, not as filler, but as fertile ground. One leader told me their breakthrough idea came during a quiet solo hour by the water. Innovation needs space to breathe. A new offsite design philosophy. Forget the PowerPoint marathons. The new offsite design should be immersive instead of performative, meaningful instead of efficient, and designed for discovery, not just alignment. Whether you're hiking a coastal trail or sitting around a campfire, the goal isn't to force productivity. It's to create the conditions where insight naturally emerges. I call this strategic restoration, a practice of slowing down, stepping back, and reconnecting with what matters most. You don't need to summit a mountain. Just start here. Change the environment. Ditch the hotel ballroom and book a retreat center near water, a creative space, or even a local museum. One client who held their offsite in a botanical garden said, "We got more creative in 2 hours than we usually do in 2 days." Next, design for emotion, not just execution. Begin with personal storytelling. Build moments of awe, sunrise, meditation, guided journaling, even shared silence. What's the emotional tone we want for this offsite to create, and why does that matter? Finally, include movement and mindfulness. Use walking meetings, breathing practices, or simple quiet space. Movement regulates the nervous system, and stillness amplifies clarity. If you're feeling bold, schedule unplugged windows with no devices, just presence. And finally, four, trust emergence. Don't overfill the schedule. Leave space for what you can't plan. That's where the breakthroughs hide. In a world addicted to speed, the leaders who pause are the ones who leap forward. In a culture obsessed with performance, the companies that reconnect with purpose are the ones that endure. So no, your next innovation breakthrough probably won't come from the hotel ballroom with the cold sandwiches and tired team-building games. It might come from a hike or a story told around a fire. Because when you design for renewal, reflection, and reconnection, strategy becomes more than a plan. It becomes a shared vision that feels alive. Sticking with Fast Company magazine, our next article is entitled Three Quick and Easy AI Chatbot Prompts That Can Help You Do Your Job Better. Get more done and spend less time doing it. Thank you, AI. Fun fact, the saying, work smarter, not harder, is coming up on its 100th birthday. Coined in the 1930s by industrial engineer Alan Morgenstern, this simple, pithy directive is arguably more achievable today than ever before. Thanks to generative AI chatbots such as OpenAI's ChatGPT, Google's Gemini, and Anthropic's Claude, it's never been easier to quickly create text, images, code, and more. Here are a few practical ways you can leverage them to power up your productivity. Create content. If you spend any time crafting marketing copy, drafting emails, outlining blog posts, or even brainstorming ideas, generative AI tools can save you an incredible amount of time. Simply input a few keywords or a brief description and watch as the AI generates initial drafts, outlines, or even complete pieces of content. Sample prompts include, write a social media post announcing a new product feature for our accounting software. Keep it under 140 characters and include relevant hashtags. Or, generate three different subject lines for an email marketing campaign promoting our summer sale. Or, create an outline for a blog post titled The 5 Benefits of Using AI for Project Management. Next, use AI to summarize information. Drowning in readables? generative AI can help you separate the wheat from the chaff far faster than even the speediest of human speed readers. You can condense lengthy documents, emails, and reports and more into concise summaries without spending hours reading them. Sample prompts include, summarize the key findings of this market research and report into a few paragraphs. Or, extract the action items from this email thread. Or, synthesize the customer feedback from this collection of online reviews into an overview of common themes. Next, use AI to generate ideas. If you're not quite ready to trust generative AI to reliably create content or summarize information for you, rest assured that it can act as a powerful brainstorming partner. You can leverage AI to generate a wide range of concepts, muscle through writer's block, or help you think of new ways to solve problems. Some sample prompts include, brainstorm 10 different marketing campaign ideas for a sustainable fashion brand targeting Gen Z. Or generate 5 unique names for a new coffee shop with a focus on local beans. Or come up with 3 different approaches to improve customer engagement on our website. And our final article for this episode, again, comes from Fast Company, entitled, Here's Why You're Still Waiting for Your Tax Refund. If you're getting antsy about when to expect your 2024 federal tax refund, here's why it might be delayed. Getting your tax refund is the only fun part of filing your taxes every year, which can make it especially galling when Uncle Sam takes his sweet time sending you money. Waiting for a refund in 2025 has some added stress considering the recent IRS layoffs and the department's plans for a 25% reduction in force, and the heartburn-inducing game of acting director musical chairs that played out during this year's tax season. With all of that turmoil in the IRS, any taxpayer still waiting on a refund may worry that their tax return got lost in the shuffle. The good news is that the IRS is still processing tax returns and refunds at a steady clip, even with a reduced workforce. Additionally, the department offers taxpayers a number of resources to soothe your worries about the status of your refund. Here's what you need to know about receiving your tax refund this year if you still haven't hit your bank account. Believe it or not, tax refunds are on track. If you've waited more than the 21 calendar days the IRS claims it takes to process the refund, you can be excused for assuming that the DOGE cuts are responsible for the delay. But the IRS filing season statistics tell a different story. Despite the reduced workforce, the IRS is processing returns and refunds at a similar rate to last year. As of April 11th, the IRS has processed 74 million refunds for the 2025 tax season, a 0.2% increase compared to the previous year. It's also instructive to look at last year's statistics from later in the tax season. The 24 refunds processed by mid-April last year represented 71% of all refunds for the calendar year. That means it's not unusual for more than a quarter of taxpayers to still be refunded less at this point in the tax season. Additionally, by May 10th, nearly 90% of refunds had been processed for the year, which correlates pretty well to the nearly 92% of taxpayers who file on time. The remaining refunds paid out after mid-May 2024 were generally owed to late filers who got an extension. If you file your taxes as of the April 15th deadline, you'll probably receive your owed refund by mid-May at the latest. So is there a tax refund delay? While the beleaguered IRS is working full steam ahead under difficult circumstances, there are several global and individual reasons why you may not have received your refund. Filing volume. The volume of tax returns received by the IRS goes up steeply the closer it gets to April 15th. The increased filing volume creates a bottleneck for IRS workers, which can delay your refund. Paper filing. Uncle Sam prefers e-filing, and taxpayers who file a paper return may have to wait 4 or more weeks to receive their refunds. Refund via check. If you requested a paper check instead of ACH deposit, that can also delay your refund. Tax credits. If you claim the Earned Income Tax Credit or the Child Tax Credit, that can delay your refund. Errors. An error on your return can delay your refund. And finally, an amended return. Filing an amended return can also cause your refund to take longer to process. One of the best updates to modern taxation is the IRS Where Is My Refund tool, which allows you to check the status of your refund. Typically, you can use this tool within 24 hours of e-filing your current year's tax return. To check your refund status, you'll need your Social Security number or individual taxpayer ID, your filing status, and the exact amount of your refund. There are three potential refund statuses: return received, refund approved, and refund sent. When should you pick up the phone? Calling the IRS for help is about as appealing as a colonoscopy, especially if you expect the wait time for reaching a real live human being to rival the runtime for Wicked, the director's cut. However, you may need to reach out to the IRS by phone if there's no change to the refund status listed on the Where's My Refund tool after 21 calendar days, or if the tool asks you to contact the IRS. Just remember that the IRS can't answer questions about your delayed refund until you've hit the 21-day mark. If you're ready to call the Taxpayer Assistance Hotline, you can reach it at 800-829-1040 from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. local time. The IRS is still working as designed for now. The 2025 tax season may seem more fraught than usual, but the IRS is still processing about the same number of returns and refunds as it has in the past. The delay on your refund may be related to when or how you filed your taxes, whether you took any credits, or if there is an error in your return. You can check the status of your refund using the online Where's My Refund tool and give the IRS a ring if the status hasn't changed after 21 days. Just remember, if you do need to call, the IRS worker who answers the phone is almost definitely having a worse tax season than you are.